Philip is always delighted to hear all oral argument. It is also delighted to hear the last oral argument for the term. And as I had announced at the first session this morning, I will repeat for the last session. This is Justice Geske's last oral argument for the term. And as you all know, she is leaving the court in early September. And on behalf of the court, I want to say how much we all enjoyed working with her for the last, is it 5 years? 5 years. And she has added very special qualities to the court. So I want to say goodbye, but not quite yet. And wish you well.
Same with you. Wish her.
96-3592, Farris County versus Good. Representing, is it Good or Goody? Good? Representing Wesley Good is John Hullo. You have 25 minutes and then time for a rebuttal. The argument for Farris County and the state of Wisconsin will be shared with Mr. Gableman of Farris County, taking 10 minutes, Corporation Counsel, and Ms. Sumi, Assistant Attorney General, taking 20. Am I right? Okay. Shall we proceed?
At the outset, Justice Geske, as a member of the bar, let me thank you for your time of service and let me wish you the best of luck. May it please the court, my name is John Hovell. I'm with the law firm of Kravitz and Gass. Seated with me at council table is my colleague, Joseph Good. I'm also pleased to introduce today my client, Mr. Wesley Good. I am here today to urge reversal of the Court of Appeals decision in this case, in which it held that under Section 59.69 sub 11 of the Wisconsin statutes, the trial court does not have the discretion to deny a request for injunctive relief that is brought by a county or a property owner within the district affected by the regulation. As a general rule, this state recognizes that public policy is made by the legislature. Stripped of its legal rhetoric, this case essentially involves a fundamental policy disagreement that the state and Forest County have with the Wisconsin legislature and the policy enacted by the statute at issue here. That disagreement concerns the methods for the enforcement of a zoning ordinance. The state and Forest County apparently believe that a zoning ordinance may not properly be enforced solely by the imposition of forfeitures, but that if the county or a landowner within the county requests it, it also has to be enforced through the issuance of injunctive relief, no matter what the equities, no matter what the discretion that the court would exercise. The legislature, on the other hand, we believe, has properly already determined that in cases the forfeitures, monetary penalties, are an appropriate means of enforcing the ordinance, but that in the discretion of the trial court, injunctive relief may be appropriate as well. This case has arrived here today because the Court of Appeals, in a split decision, apparently accepted the policy arguments advanced by the state and Forest County. In so doing, however, the Court of Appeals itself expressed trepidation about its decision. As it said, to the legally trained mind, our decision limiting the court's discretionary role in the equity arena may appear impertinent. Despite recognizing that its decision may appear impertinent to the legally trained mind, this court reached its result, I submit, because of its policy considerations. As it said near the conclusion of its opinion, one should not be permitted at the trial court's discretion to purchase through forfeitures a variance from a zoning code. This court is essentially confronted with two basic issues here today. Issue number one is whether the rules of statutory interpretation or statutory construction adopted through the years by this court permit the Court of Appeals to have interpreted the statute at issue as it did. We believe that those rules do not permit that interpretation. The second issue, and one that only needs to be reached if it is determined that the rules of statutory interpretation do permit the Court of Appeals to have reached this result, is whether that interpretation of the statute violates the separation of powers doctrine set forth in Section 2 of Article 7 of the Wisconsin Constitution. We believe that such an interpretation of the statute does violate the separation of powers doctrine. Let me first begin my argument with the statutory interpretation issue. There is a two-step process in the state for the interpretation of statutes. Step number one is to look at the plain language of the statute. If the language is unambiguous, you interpret the statute based on that unambiguous, cold, written language. You need look no further. Only in the event that the language is deemed to be ambiguous does the second step apply. That step then involves looking beyond the language of the statute, because it is ambiguous, to attempt to discern the intent of the legislature when it enacted the statute. We believe that all the rules of statutory interpretation at issue here compel the result that Section 59.69 sub 11 of the Wisconsin statutes permits the trial court to exercise its well-founded equitable discretion in determining whether or not to grant a request for injunctive relief when there has been a violation of a zoning ordinance. First, we believe that the plain language of the statute provides for this result. Let me read that language briefly, if I may. In part, the statute provides, and I quote, "The ordinances shall be enforced by appropriate forfeitures. The compliance with such ordinances may also be enforced by injunctional order at the suit of the county or an owner of real estate within the district affected by the regulation."
Okay, now, so in this particular case, the county doesn't give a variance and the house appears to be in violation of the ordinance, right?
Right.
So here is a suit to enforce the ordinance, right?
Yes.
And it's brought by the county?
Yes, it is.
Who else could have brought this?
The lawsuit under the statute could have been brought either by the county or a property owner within the district affected by the regulation.
What does that mean?
And that's a good question. I myself, I've attempted to figure that out. I think that as I interpret it here, and I couldn't find any authority on point on this, I believe that it's probably a suit that could be brought by any other property owner within the county, because it is a county ordinance.
And that person could bring a suit if there had been no request for a variance, or if there had been a denial of a variance and no enforcement by the county?
Yes.
Or if the county opted just to ask for a forfeiture, a property owner could ask for an injunction?
Yes.
So those are all possibilities.
That's the way I would interpret the statute. I believe that's the logical interpretation of the statute.
Well, suppose the county had granted a variance and a property owner thought that was just outrageous, didn't fit within the requirements of the statute or ordinance for giving a variance, and that everything is going down the tubes in terms of land development as a result of this. Could that person then sue?
I've attempted to look at that issue as well, Your Honor, and I would be inclined to believe that, yes, they probably could sue, but I would tend to think that the lawsuit would be unsuccessful. I believe that the way I would interpret it is that once the variance is granted, that person then is in compliance with the county ordinance by virtue of the variance.
So you think this comes up only where they're not in compliance?
I beg your pardon?
This, you use 59.69, whatever the number is, only where the property is not in compliance with the county ordinance, not to challenge with the county board or appropriate.
I believe that is how I would interpret the ordinance, yes, Your Honor.
Do you still think it's unambiguous?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. I think the
just checking.
That's a fair comment, and let me attempt to explain why, please. What we're talking about, in some respects, is really issues of standing, not interpretation of the language of the ordinance that I've just read. Critical to the language, to the interpretation of the ordinance, in terms of the excerpts of it that I just read, is the use of the words in that section of the ordinance of both shall and may, in connection with the enforcement of zoning ordinances. This court has recognized on numerous occasions through the years that the word shall is generally presumed to be mandatory. This court has also recognized through the years that as a general rule, and I realize there are exceptions, the word may is usually defined to be permissive. And indeed, in the Swiatek decision, the court stated that may implies a discretionary element. The difference in the meaning of these words, shall and may, is no more pronounced than when they are used in the same statute and in the same context.
The problem I have with that argument is that the argument can be made that the may or shall applies to the petitioner, that either the property owner or the county may ask for an injunction, and the, you know, what is the subject of may, and that's what, it seems to me, very difficult to ascertain in reading that statute.
And I think what you're suggesting is, and this is perhaps what the Court of Appeals was suggesting, and that is that the word may, as used in the statute, permits discretion on behalf of the county or a property owner within the district affected by the regulation.
They have the option.
Not
even discretion. It's an option that they have in addition to forfeiture.
Even if that is the case, if may were to be construed as that way, there is nothing in the statute whatsoever that would suggest that if a request for injunctive relief is brought, that the trial court doesn't have its equitable powers available to it in terms of ruling on the, in terms of balancing the equities, otherwise looking at whatever factors are pertinent in terms of ruling on the request for injunctive relief.
So that the statute's silent as to the court's role in deciding whether an injunction has to be given if they qualify by factually or has the option of using its discretion.
Exactly. Let me, if I may, and I'm going to take my argument out of turn here because I want to bring to your attention a case that I think might help address that a little bit in terms of might help explain what the legislature had in mind when it enacted the ordinance. I personally believe that the plain language of the ordinance doesn't require us to go even further, but even if we were to go further, there's a decision of this court in 1924. Now, the dates are pertinent here. 1923 is when the legislature enacted Section 59.97, which is now the Section 59.69. But the enforcement provisions of that ordinance were not enacted in 1923. To the contrary, they were enacted 4 years later in 1927 as Section 59.97 sub 4 of the statute. That has now been renumbered as Section 59.69 sub 11. But at that time, it was 59.97 sub 4. In 1924, this court decided Holzbauer versus Ritter. In that case, there was a request for a temporary restraining order brought by members, other landowners, I believe, in the city that was affected by the zoning ordinance at issue there. And in doing that, in looking at the case, this court had to consider or take into account the decisions of this court in City of Janesville, which I've discussed in my brief, and Waupun versus Moore. The court in Holzbauer, after discussing and mentioning City of Janesville and Waupun versus Moore, stated, "We do not think these cases go farther than to hold that a municipal corporation may not seek equitable relief to enforce its own ordinances. They have a perfectly adequate remedy at law by bringing actions to enforce the penalties prescribed." In the paragraph following that in the Holzbauer case, the court did say that landowners, however, unlike the city, had the right, if their rights in the property were substantially damaged by the violation of the ordinance, they had a right to seek what the court referred to as equitable relief. Now, I submit that in 1927, when the court enacted the enforcement provision of the ordinance at issue here, it had in mind not only the law in effect at the time in the state providing for the fact that equitable remedy, or that injunctive relief is an equitable remedy that's vested into the trial court, not only the City of Janesville decision in which this court had struck down in 1890 a statute, it struck it down as violative of the separation of powers doctrine on the grounds that it compelled that an injunction should be issued if to restrain the construction of a building in violation of an ordinance without proof of any injury. We believe that it had that in mind, but we believe that when it enacted this statute in 1927, it likely wanted to say, look, the county too has standing to enforce its ordinances by invoking the equitable powers of the court. That, look, Supreme Court, we appreciate your reasoning in Holzbauer. We understand what you're saying, but we want to change the law in that regard. And we want to say that just like an affected property owner in that district, the state, the county as well, would have standing to bring an action to enforce its zoning ordinances. That would be somewhat counter to what the decision in Holzbauer had held. So in that regard, that may actually suggest that the may language in there does grant the discretion, or at least the standing, to both of them to bring injunctive relief. But going back to the statute itself, I don't see anything in the statute itself that provides that it's doing anything more than invoking the equitable powers of a court that historically have been entrusted to the discretion of the court in terms of balancing the equities, whatever it might be, in terms of ruling on that request for injunctive relief.
Let me tell you the problem, and one of the stronger arguments I think that the state has here, which is that if that is the interpretation, then a court can basically undermine a county's decision not to grant a variance. That they go through the whole process and the decision is made that a variance not be granted, and yet, you know, you can get a forfeiture, you can get money, but the shoreline is not going to be the protection that the county or whoever it is that's complaining believes is important. It can be undermined by a judge's discretion.
Your Honor, I appreciate that concern, and I recognize, and assuming it was kind enough yesterday to work within the decision that came out of this court yesterday in Kenosha County Board of Adjustment, and which dealt with shoreline zoning ordinances. But even in there, even in that decision, this court talked about the fact that the purpose of them was to enforce a uniform setback that preserves the public's interest in shoreland in the navigable waters of the state. Critical, I believe, in this decision is the use of the words to enforce. I believe that your question really goes to a policy argument in terms of how you go about enforcing zoning ordinances. I believe that the state and Forest County, and I understand where they're coming from, take the position that it is not sufficient to grant or to enforce a zoning ordinance merely by issuing forfeitures. And in that case, I think they're wrong. I think, first of all, the legislature has spoken by saying ordinances shall be enforced by appropriate forfeitures, and compliance may also be enforced by injunctional order. But I think also we are losing sight of the fact that if a forfeiture is imposed, there was almost a $9,000 forfeiture imposed against this gentleman by the trial court, and in doing for the violation of the ordinance, in doing that, the trial court took pains, the record shows, to try to come up with an amount that would deter future violations of the ordinance. I don't believe a $9,000 forfeiture constitutes the purchase of a variance. He doesn't have a variance. He has a non-conforming use, perhaps. I'm not sure what you want to classify it, but he didn't get a variance. The variance would come without purchasing it. You can't purchase a variance, and I think it would be poor public policy to even suggest that you can actually purchase a variance.
I just have one follow-up question to this. I know there was a dispute at the trial court and ultimately at the Court of Appeals about the amount of the forfeiture. This is just a procedural question. I don't know the answer to this. I think the Court of Appeals, when they calculated, they simply used the trial date, I think, as the end date. Can he be assessed future forfeitures for an ongoing violation if there's no injunctive relief? Is that the next question?
I think that's probably the next case is what I think it probably is. I don't know. I think the Court of Appeals decision, and you'll note that we did not petition for review of the Court of Appeals decision on the forfeiture. The Court of Appeals did not accept our argument in terms of the calculation of the forfeiture being correct. Instead, it determined that it should go, I believe, from the filing of the complaint up through the time of the conclusion of trial. And I think what you're saying, could there be this ongoing penalty?
They start another one saying from the date of that trial until today's date and just have a continuing request for forfeitures.
Your Honor, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm not sure. I thought of that issue again, and I have to admit, I could not come up with an answer. I could not, quite frankly, come up with a better response than what I'm offering you right now.
Thank you.
Okay? I'm sorry, Justice.
As I see this case in the opinion of the majority of the Court of Appeals, you have the flip side. Both sides are concerned about invading the powers, one of the court and the other of the county board. If you take one interpretation, that is, if the county board asks for an injunction, they say that the court has to grant it. And of course, then you can scream, "Oh, you're invading the powers of the court. We have that discretion." The flip side of that is if the court has the discretion to grant or not grant an injunction, it's really invading the powers of the county board. That is, it is creating judicial variances, and variances are a decision to be left to the county board. That was the tension and is the tension between the majority and the dissent as I see it. Now, the tiebreaker goes to exactly what you had said earlier. It's poor public policy to let someone buy by variances. And this is what the Court of Appeals majority opinion said. To the legally trained mind, our decision limiting the court's discretionary role in the equity arena may appear impertinent, but we find it far less disturbing than the position that courts, under the mantle of balancing the equities, can permit defendants to violate statutes with impunity. One should not be permitted at the trial court's discretion to purchase through forfeitures a variance from a zoning code. I read that sentence, that last sentence, as really the essence of the Court of Appeals majority opinion. What can you say to counteract that concern? When I say essence, I mean there's a shifting of powers. They're balancing, and that was the tiebreaker.
I understand, Your Honor. Let me attempt to explain that if I can, and then offer an example as to why I think the hard and fast rule set forth by the Court of Appeals is not going to be workable and is going to potentially reach some very unreasonable results. First of all, I again do not believe that you're purchasing a variance. Maybe the answer is, as Justice Geske suggested, I don't know this and I'm not sure, I haven't really researched it from that point, that the penalty, the forfeiture, should be more continue over time. I'm not sure that's the case. I certainly don't recommend that in that case, and I'm not sure it's consistent with the law in the state in terms of construing Section 59.69 sub 11. But the hard and fast rule, I believe, is first of all, you've got to respect one thing, and that is the enforcement of an ordinance or the enforcement of other laws through forfeitures. That does not constitute purchasing a variance. Variances cannot be purchased. More importantly, I think you've got to respect the judiciary. You've got to respect the powers of the judiciary. Let me offer this example, if I can, to see if this helps in terms of...
I'm concerned about this example. I know a number of people, shoreline property, have lots of money, and they want to build closer because it gives them a view for their retirement home. And they would gladly pay $9,000 or $10,000 to have the house located where they want it to, or $20,000.
Your Honor, I appreciate that. And I think that's where we've got to respect the discretion of the trial court. I think the trial court has to factor those into its balancing of the equities. I am not saying injunctions are not appropriate. I am not saying that injunctions should never be granted in this case. What I am saying is that it is up to the trial court to exercise its discretion, as it has through almost 150 years of the existence of the state, to determine whether an injunction is appropriate. That's what I'm saying. And let me, if I can, try to break the tie the other way, please, by offering this example. The ordinance, as we've discussed, permits a property owner or the county to seek injunctive relief. Let's imagine that business ABC is constructed in violation of a county zoning ordinance. Let's imagine that the county, at the time the business is constructed, knows about the violation of the ordinance and decides, for whatever reason, that it does not want to do anything with it. Or better yet, let's assume that the county says, well, look, we're just going to seek a monetary forfeiture from you. We're not going to seek injunctive relief. Let's imagine that Mr. X is sitting there a mile away and knows that this business was built in violation of the zoning ordinance. Doesn't do anything about it. Maybe even goes and consults a lawyer, and the lawyer says, geez, if you don't like it, you can do something about it. Mr. X says no. But then let's imagine that 4 years later, Mr. X decides to start a business that competes with ABC business. Then he starts thinking, oh, wait a minute, that business is not conforming, something's wrong here. So to jumpstart his business, to put his business at some advantage, to force real problems with business ABC, he brings an injunctive action in the circuit court for that county. Under the Court of Appeals interpretation of that statute, the court would have no discretion then to deny the variance. It would have to grant the variance if there is a proven violation of the zoning ordinance. I would submit that would throw on its head the law of latches in this state that applies to this exact situation. There's a case, I believe it's Dunn versus Deal, that this court decided in 1960 when residents of the city of Lake Geneva waited 3.5 years to bring an action to enforce a zoning ordinance because there was some business that they didn't like in the Lake Geneva at the time. And this court said, wait a minute, you waited too long. You sat on your hands. Equitable relief can be barred by latches, and that's what's going on here, and you can't get the injunctive relief. That's why, Your Honor, I think in appropriate situations, the trial court has to be in a position to take those factors into account.
Counsel, following along with this in the balance of power and who is going to have this final say. As I recall in this record, this very same board had granted, or maybe its predecessor had granted, some variances where the lot owner had been able to construct. I think I may be wrong on the facts, but I thought it was one of them was within 18 feet of the shoreline. So wouldn't that, in that case, that's sort of a reverse spin on this, but I know that Judge Kennedy used that as part of his reasoning process when he granted this, when he denied this particular injunction.
Absolutely, Justice, and I believe that that is an appropriate factor as well to consider. I mean, I think the record showed, and I wanted to rebut or reserve some time for rebuttal, but if not, that's fine, too.
You get it. You get 5 minutes.
Yeah, you get 5 minutes. Oh, okay, I'm sorry, that's right. Okay. I believe that the record demonstrates that Judge Kennedy took that into consideration, and I think that's an appropriate factor to take into consideration. I appreciate Forest County wanting to protect its shoreline. I appreciate that. But at some point, it becomes rather strange how its variances of this nature are routinely granted to others, but for some reason it's denied. I think it's appropriate for a trial court, amongst all the other factors I'm suggesting, latches, the motivation for someone seeking the injunction, the history of the county in relation to enforcing the shoreline zoning ordinances, I believe those are all factors that the law requires the trial court to consider in balancing the equities and determining whether or not to grant injunctive relief.
Let me ask you, because looking in the back of the statutes and the index, the index on injunctions are two columns long. I mean, there's all sorts of injunctive relief as remedies, or have you, and I ask if you've looked at every one of them, but is there anywhere that you know of that when somebody meets some certain qualifying factors that a court has to give injunctive relief?
I do believe the state cites in its brief the Pure Milk Products decision, and that may be what you're referring to, where there is, and that they talk about it as being, my time is up, may I finish,
yes,
please? They talk about that being a statutory injunction. I believe that, first of all, that's totally different than here. The statute was written differently. But second, I believe that that statute could very easily run afoul, and as I explained in my brief, does run afoul of the separation of powers doctrine as well, because we still have city
Other than
law.
That, are you aware of any other area that one has, that a judge must enter an injunction if certain qualifying facts are proven?
Your Honor, to be perfectly honest with you, I may have seen some, but I, at this point, I just can't remember. I apologize.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if I can recall any.
Okay, your time is up, Counselor.
Okay.
You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Gableman, you have 10 minutes. Forest County Corporation Council, representing Forest County.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. My name is Mike Gableman. I appear today in my capacity as the Assistant Corporation Counsel for Forest County. I appear also today with Ms. Mary Ann Sumi of the Department of Justice.
Counsel, I'm just going to interrupt you a moment. You may raise that podium if you wish.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice.
I think you'll be closer to the microphone and we can hear you.
And be sure you lower it back to your co-counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Justice Babbage. Honorable Justices, it is a privilege for me to be here today to represent the viewpoint of the people of Forest County, that this case provides this court with the opportunity to expressly hold that exception from the laws and regulations which govern the regulation of our zoning and protection of our natural resources and the safeguard of them cannot be purchased. I will address in my time before you two distinct areas, and those are the pertinent facts as Forest County sees them, and the specific reasons for the importance that Forest County places on the ability of the County's Zoning Board of Adjustment to administer setback regulations. As to the facts, it's been suggested throughout briefing that somehow petitioner, through no fault of his own, suffered a circumstance whereby he now finds his home in violation of the setback requirements. The facts suggest otherwise. We know that in the spring of 1993, it was the desire of the petitioner to remove an existing structure, a small one-bedroom cabin. It was his desire to replace it with a larger home fit for year-round habitation and to put it as close to the lake as possible. And we know that in June of 1993, Ms. Dawn Schmidt, the Forest County Zoning Administrator met with the petitioner on his property for the purpose of determining where, how close to the ordinary high water mark that cabin could be placed. And we know that the normal regulation is 75 feet, but by the process known as averaging, Ms. Schmidt informed the petitioner that that cabin could be placed 50 feet from the ordinary high water mark. And we know that Ms. Schmidt told the petitioner in no uncertain terms, to use her words that were in the trial transcript, Ms. Schmidt told the petitioner, be damn sure before you excavate that that home is no closer than 50 feet.
And none of this really makes any difference, does it? I mean, whether or not any of this occurred or none of it occurred, your position is if there's a violation and the county wants to proceed and is able to prove there's a violation, whether or not they were really good at warning them or not good at all, it wouldn't matter, would it?
Madam Justice Geske, as far as the end result, the answer to your question is no. As far as the pertinent facts of this particular case, it will.
I mean, these kinds of facts that might go to an injunction.
That's true.
The discretionary call on an injunction as opposed to a mandatory issuance of an injunction.
And as part of that, which was brought up by Mr. Hobel, there had been variances, other variances granted, and as discussed by Mr. Justice Wilcox. But from that trial transcript, the record is silent as to whether those particular variances were granted as a result of averaging. For instance, the 18 feet. It is possible through that process of averaging to reduce the amount of setback from the ordinary high water mark. And that is another pertinent factor in this matter.
I want to ask you how this statute's construed and applied. Here, the house is in violation. They didn't get the variance, it's in violation. The town can sue, and the county can sue here, and it did. Could a neighbor sue?
A resident in the affected area could bring
that
suit.
What does that mean?
A resident
within the district affected. I mean, you have to give notice to certain people in the city. You have to give notice to people within a certain radius if you want a variance.
And the best way I can answer that is to review how this particular violation was found, and that is someone in that area, a particular man in that area, noticed. And so...
But you sued. Forest County sued. Could that man sue under this statute? I know he didn't, but could he?
Yes, if he was a resident of the affected district.
All right. And suppose the county had granted a variance and this man didn't think that was right and that the county didn't apply the appropriate standard. Could he sue under those conditions?
The means by which to achieve a variance of this type of regulation is by the Board of Adjustment. And that Board of Adjustment has it within its power to apply those, you know, unnecessary hardship, the three factors set forth to issue that variance. So that variance would have been issued. And as far as whether that resident could have still brought suit, that perhaps would have would raise some questions akin to res judicata.
But wouldn't that be a, just so I understand the answer, so in other words, if the zoning board had done exactly, in other words, they had granted something 25 feet and the neighbor said, no, it has to be within 50, what's your answer then, that they would come in under, this neighbor could come in and ask for injunctive relief? Just so I understand what you're saying.
And the short answer is I'm not quite sure. I do know, though, that the only method to achieve that variance is by the Board of Adjustment, and they have it within their power to grant or deny using those specific terms. And as my answer to the Madam Chief Justice was, perhaps the suit such as you described, Mr. Justice Wilcox, is would be akin to res judicata.
Let's take another fact situation, though. Let's have the county, in this case, decide that the forfeiture is sufficient, that they want to recover a forfeiture from the homeowner, but they don't want to go ahead with the injunction. And as a matter of public policy and all the things that the county has to consider, they've reached that conclusion. That neighbor or that person living in the area, however that's defined, files a request for an injunction. Your position is that the trial judge must grant it, despite the fact the county does not want to. Is that right?
Well, according to the law in County of Columbia v. Bieluski, if there is that offending structure, and it cannot be made legally, it can't be modifiable to be within conformity.
Do we have that here? Are those facts here?
No.
There.
This structure...
Can be made?
Yes, it can be moved.
Okay. All right.
Well, what I hear you saying, and maybe this is more appropriately put to Nasumi, but what I hear you saying is that you want the law interpreted so that the court cannot trump the county or the zoning board, but a citizen living in a district affected can.
Well, the county submits...
Isn't that...
Well, the county submits, first of all, that there are the rules of certiorari review that can be applied. And secondly, I'm not quite sure of the end analysis that would be provided.
I'll put it to the Senate.
Mr. Gableman, does the record reflect what the cost would be to the homeowner to bring this home into conformity with the ordinance?
Mr. Justice Crooks, the transcript indicates that after an on-site inspection was conducted by the trial court and by counsel, the trial court, using its own knowledge of the construction industry, put the price at $25,000 to $30,000, but said it would be possible to move the home without destroying the entire basement.
Why wouldn't that fact, that situation, that cost, present an unnecessary hardship?
The unnecessary hardship would have been created by the petitioner himself, and in that case would be divergent from those facts in those cases where, because of the nature of the land itself, such as the presence of a swamp or the inability somehow because of the geographic nature of the particular land, that no other use could have been made. The hardship here was self-imposed.
Didn't the judge find, and Judge Kennedy find, that this was an unintentional violation?
Judge Kennedy found that he was not convinced that it was intentional.
Does that make any difference as far as unnecessary hardship?
The county submits no. The county submits that no, and that the county also points out that there, of course, are other civil remedies that lie. Suit against any parties who may be responsible, if that turns out to be the case. And furthermore, the county submits that injunction should lie, if anything, to protect the natural resources 15 feet here, and I know the red light is on, and I have one sentence.
You may finish your sentence, please.
15 feet here, 15 feet there on this lake or that may not seem like much in the individual, but compounded and multiplied by the aggregate for potential offenses in similar vein. It isn't difficult for the county to imagine a time when there is no need for zoning requirements or regulations because there's nothing left to protect. The county respectfully requests this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, Mr. Gableman. Sumi? Long time. May it please the court. My name is Mary Ann Sumi, Assistant Attorney General, and I'm representing Intervenor State of Wisconsin in this case. The state joins Forest County in asking this court to affirm the Court of Appeals decision because it carries out the legislative intent to protect shorelands through local zoning. State will focus on two areas of argument. First, statutory interpretation, and secondly, whether the Court of Appeals decision unconstitutionally usurps judicial power. But first, to respond to Justice Babich's question, I'd like to discuss what the words may be enforced by injunctional order mean and who they apply to, who has that right. It appears from the wording of the statute that it is either the county who may enforce, that's pretty clear,
or an owner of real estate within the district affected by the regulation. And I put emphasis on affected by the regulation. I think that means that not just any property owner in the county can come in and try to seek injunctional relief, that you must be affected by the regulation.
Well, why can't any property owner have an interest in having setback requirements enforced? And all you need to be is an owner of real estate within the district affected by the regulation. Even if you're not a neighbor, you can be affected by it.
I agree that there's probably more than one reasonable interpretation of those words, but I think to give this provision meaning and, I guess, effectiveness, you would want only those affected by the regulation to be able to come into court and seek to enjoin this activity, as well as the county.
Well, the reason you're here, as I understand it, on behalf of the people of the state, because you think that these people have an interest in protecting shorelines and not necessarily adjacent property owners exclusively. I mean, it seems to
that would apply to every citizen in the state. All counties must, by state law, adopt ordinances just like this. So conceivably any property owner in the state could have an interest in ensuring compliance in Forest County. And I don't think that's what the statute is suggesting here.
Well, Ms. Sumi, I'm not sure if I made my point clear with your co-counsel. Your position, correct me if I'm wrong, but your position is that if the county goes to court to enforce, to get an injunction, the court has no discretion. The court must grant it, assuming that there's been a violation.
Assuming that there is a continuing violation.
Right. Assuming that all that's met. So in other words, another way of saying that is that the court cannot trump the decision of the zoning board.
That's correct.
Now, if the zoning board, however, decides not to enforce by injunction, under the law, a citizen affected by it can trump the decision of the zoning board.
Yes.
And I don't know if that makes sense or not, and that's the point. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, at least intuitively. My gut tells me that doesn't make a lot of sense in terms of interpreting this statute.
I think it does make sense because there are a lot of reasons why a county may not seek injunctional relief. Maybe lack of personnel to be able to go to court and choices, priorities have to be set. And perhaps there is just not enough interest in pursuing this violation. There may be an affected property owner, though, who does have the interest and the need to see that the injunction is brought to court. I think it does make some sense.
Well, and it's also keeping the county board on its toes. It is a violation of the law. If the county doesn't care, citizens can.
That's right. And that is a reason, too, for a narrower interpretation of people affected by, people who have standing to go into court and seek injunctive relief, that you really have to have some interest in enforcement in the statute to be there.
Well, what bothers me about this is, ordinarily, a court has discretion on an injunction and weighs and balances. And when you use the word injunction, you carry with it all of its freight, which are dozens of years, hundreds of years old. So on an initial reading a brief, it says, hey, this is a requirement, must do. Just that doesn't make sense to me.
Well, and I think the Court of Appeals using a term like impertinent to the trained legal mind sort of suggests that this is troubling to all of us who believe in the tradition of equitable jurisprudence, and how can it be that the legislature can adopt a statute that says, no court, you don't really have that discretion anymore. Part of that discretion is taken away. But what I would emphasize is that what has been taken away by the legislature is only a part of that discretion.
You want to explain to me how you think the legislature has taken that away? What language shows us that that's what they wanted to do?
The Court of Appeals interpretation, as you know, was that the words may referred only to those who may seek injunctive relief.
Yeah, and I think that's a reasonable reading, that the property owner may do it and that the county may. But where does it say that the judge must grant an injunction without using his or her own discretion?
And I think to reach that question, you almost have to concede that the language is ambiguous if you don't adopt the Court of Appeals construction. And once it is ambiguous, if these words are not plain, then the court has to interpret the language to give effect to legislative intent. Now, at least two legislative purposes are in play here. First being the desire to protect shorelands and shoreland values, which were discussed in the decision issued yesterday. And secondly, though, to provide an orderly and fair process by which local zoning decisions are made.
Isn't there also another theory of construction is that the legislature, in using the word injunction, knows what comes with an injunction, which is historically that the court entertains all the equitable factors and makes a discretionary decision?
Yes, and that is what's troubling about this case. However, one has to look at the result if we are allowed to say the court has the full panoply of injunctive powers here, because in effect, the court can then sidestep the whole local zoning authority and grant judicial variances. And I think Justice Bradley said that that is the crux of the case, and I think it is.
Well, subject to review, of course.
Subject to review.
And as we reviewed just a case that we released yesterday in which we overturned a circuit court.
That's correct, but even in that case and in the Arndorfer case before it, this court was very careful to say we will not substitute our judgment for the judgment of the Board of Adjustment. And in both cases, the cases were remanded to the Board of Adjustment to make those findings and decisions. So I think there's the recognition that courts, once a court is in the process, it doesn't have unfettered discretion to provide whatever relief might be available.
Ms. Sunny, I'm curious as to why you haven't taken a different tack. Instead of arguing that this statute has to be interpreted to curtail the equitable powers of courts, why haven't you argued that it's an erroneous exercise of discretion that occurred in this case by the trial judge?
Those arguments were made in the briefs, but I think we felt our duty was to defend the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Do you agree with the decision of the Court of Appeals?
Yes, for the most part. I believe that probably this statute is subject to more than one reasonable interpretation, and only that way would I depart with the Court of Appeals.
But that way causes us to curtail for the future the equitable powers of courts in regard to granting injunctions, does it not?
Curtail, possibly limit, but not eliminate. The Court of Appeals decision is careful to limit the injunctive power of the court. And the exercise of discretion that remains lies in tailoring the remedy. In other words, the court can't, for instance, order injunctive relief if the violation is stopped. The court can perhaps exercise discretion as to the timing and the scope of relief. The court can also adjust the remedy to make sure that it is not more than compliance with the statute. But the important thing is that the relief, the injunction, must require compliance with the statute. Otherwise, the statute has been vitiated.
What's the state's position, and I don't know if you have one, on if the trial court was right and the Court of Appeals was wrong in terms of ongoing forfeitures? Question I asked Petitioner's Counsel.
I think that there is authority to go for ongoing forfeitures, and to that I would say what a waste of prosecutorial and judicial resources. And secondly, how fair is that to the petitioner to have constantly hanging over his head the threat that perhaps he'll be brought to court for more forfeitures? It seems the interest of finality would suggest that injunctive relief be required in these kinds of cases where there is a proven statutory violation.
Other than the Pure Milk case, there are other, same question that Justice Geske asked before, are there any other statutes that mandate that upon initiation of a suit and the prerequisites are met, the court must enjoin?
Well, I believe that the Fonks mobile home case, which is cited in our brief, talks about the need not to prove a statutory violation. And even the Bielewski case, which is cited on both sides of the issue, talks about the, although it does not directly address because it wasn't involved in that case, what happens when there's a proven statutory violation. You may not need to prove the elements of an injunction. But I don't think there is a case that directly leads the way on this issue, and I think that's what makes it an interesting case. May I address for a moment the separation of powers argument? The Court of Appeals interpretation of 59-69-11 does not usurp judicial power. In fact, I think the argument could be just as strongly made that to let the lower court decision stand would usurp legislative power. Separation of powers analysis looks at core functions of each of the three coordinate branches. When a court exempts a defendant from a legislative enactment, it is taking over a core function of the legislature. When a court enforces statutes by applying them to individual fact situations, the court is exercising its own core functions. In our case, the legislature in section 59.692 directed that standards for shoreline protection be promulgated and that counties like Forest County adopt them, as well as standards for a variance. The court's role is to enforce those standards and not to rewrite them. The moment that a judge sitting as a court of equity considers whether a statute or ordinance must be obeyed, then I think the court has stepped into the legislative arena and the arguments become very strong that it is the judiciary that has overstepped its bounds and not the legislature. I would like to take a minute to talk about the, the harsh consequences or perceived harsh consequences to the petitioner in this case. I think it takes a heart of stone not to feel some sympathy for someone who has built a house and now, because of an error, is being asked to remove or move part of the house. But the state would say, what about the next applicant for a building permit? Could he or she be denied a variance? What about fairness to the applicant who has used the statutory procedure and tried to seek a variance and has appealed and gone through all the steps that the statutes provide? The petitioner in this case didn't appeal the denial of his variance and yet got a variance, a judicial variance anyway. And then what about the public's interest in maintaining adequate setbacks addressed so well in yesterday's Kenosha County Board of Adjustment case? At the trial in this case, one of petitioner's witnesses testified that the beauty and tranquility of Round Hemlock Lake were so important to him. And he said, you know, you should go to Roberts Lake, which is nearby. You should see it. It's all built up. It looks just like a city. And the state would suggest that's the point here. That's what we're trying to prevent. This is what the ordinance is trying to achieve, prevention of the overdevelopment of shorelines. No one takes satisfaction in asking that a part of a home be moved, but the alternatives do not serve the public interest. And with that, I'll conclude unless there are other questions.
Sumi, I've got another question. You were talking before about the approach taken by the Court of Appeals when the Court of Appeals talks about perhaps usurping legislative powers. What if we were to approach this case saying this is an area of shared power, that this is an area where the legislature has the right to set the standards, but the court has the right to decide what the appropriate remedy is? What's wrong with that?
Well, I think you probably could see it in the area of shared powers because, as the court well knows, having had at least two separation of power cases this term, the area of shared powers seems to grow. The area of exclusive core functions seems to be shrinking. And I think you can see this as one of those overlapping powers and still maintain the decision of the Court of Appeals. That's because there is no undue intrusion on the court's prerogative. As I said earlier, we're not seeking to eliminate the trial court's discretion. We're just trying to make sure that the trial court has discretion within the bounds of compliance, no more and no less.
Well, but you are eliminating it in terms of whether an injunctive relief is granted or not. I mean, the decision, in effect, says trial courts, once the factual basis is there, trial courts have no discretion in deciding whether to grant injunctive relief or not. What you're arguing is that the terms of that injunction, once it's granted, still give the trial judge. So I suppose, you know, the judge can say, I'm going to give him the next 50 years to do this and give all these reasons, and then it's a question of whether that's an erroneous exercise of discretion. But there is no discretion under the Court of Appeals opinion in your position as to whether or not injunctive relief is an appropriate remedy.
That's correct.
Could I'm just sitting back here thinking, gee, this might be a case that should have gone to mediation. Maybe if you agreed to keep it up for 5 years and then take it down, could a trial judge, in exercising powers under this, say that you've got 5 years to take it down?
I believe that Forest County and the state would object to that and possibly appeal as an erroneous exercise of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sully. Mr. Hovell.
Thank you. Let me just address, if I may, in quickly several points that they've raised. First of all, I believe it was Mr. Justice Wilcox's argument. They did not argue, from what I recall at all, in the Court of Appeals, that the trial court abused its discretion. They argued simply that the trial court had no discretion. They did not bring that issue up. Second, Mr. Gableman talked about the averaging and trying to, if I understood it correctly, indicate that you didn't know if that 18-foot was because there was an averaging. In footnote 1 of the Court of Appeals decision is the ordinance quotation from the ordinance at issue here, and at the very end of it, it says, except that in no case shall the setback be less than 50 feet. So clearly, the averaging could not have permitted the 18-foot variance. Ms. Sumi, and I appreciate her candor here, because in response to your question, I believe Justice Geske, she indicated that she couldn't identify the language that said that the trial court had to grant the injunction, and she said that, I guess that suggests that we must concede that the language is ambiguous in order to reach that result. I submit otherwise. I submit there is no language that is ambiguous. The language is absent. For the language to be ambiguous, the language must be present. That language is not present. There is nothing at all to suggest that result, I think, under the way the statute's written. As for the argument that the trial court, the one resident of the county is able to trump the decision of the county board not to seek injunctive relief, I agree. That's essentially part of my brief, I think, at pages 23 and 24, in terms of exactly why I believe how this reaches such an unreasonable result. It's an absurd result that one person can decide what should be the fate of this home, even if the county board in its wisdom had decided not to grant it. As for the moving of the home, the cost of it, Justice Crooks, I believe that and it's cited in detail on pages 38 to 40 of my brief, but the trial court found that it was $25,000 to $30,000 to remove the home, plus the corresponding damage to the home itself. In addition, the county conceded, Don Schmidt, the zoning administrator, conceded that it would be very, very expensive. I believe those are her words, to move the home. As for the interpretation of that phrase, the owner of the owner of real estate within the district affected by the regulation, if I understood Ms. Sumi correctly, she's trying to say that it's really an owner who's affected by the regulation, and I'm not sure that that result can at all be reached by the statute. I think the wording says an owner of real estate within the district affected by the regulation. So I think you focus on the district, and anyone who owns real estate within that district would be someone who would have standing to commence the litigation to seek injunctive relief, not someone who was affected by the regulation. With that in mind, I thank you very much for your time. If you have no questions, I conclude my remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Hubble. With that, we adjourn for June, and we'll see you all in September. Thank you.